Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Athens, Greece, and speak with Irini Espathiou, a Greek-American artist and supporter of Syriza, the new party that opposes the austerity measures that 60,000 Greeks took to the streets yesterday to protest. We will discuss the general strike and today's agreement by the three-party ruling coalition on a package of spending cuts. Then we'll examine the escalating tensions in the East Pacific between China, Japan, and Taiwan over a territorial dispute that has been simmering for over a century. The Washington editor-at-large of The Atlantic, Stephen Clemens, joins us. He co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, and we will discuss how both Japan and China are raising the stakes, with Japan nationalizing the Senkaku Islands and China seeking UN support to expand its continental shelf claim to include the islands. Then finally, we'll speak with a veteran political professional, Stephen Hill, who has been working to reform America's broken election systems for decades. He has an article at The Nation, The Blue State Strategy for Progressive Change, that argues the Democrats should focus on making voting easier in states where they control the governorships and legislatures instead of whining about aggressive efforts on the part of Republicans to suppress Democratic votes in states that they control. Joining us now from Athens, Greece, is Irini Espathiou, a Greek-American artist who is a supporter of Syriza, the new party on the left opposed to the Greek government's austerity measures imposed on the Greek people by the European Union and the IMF. Welcome to Background Briefing, Irini Espathiou.
Hi.
And yesterday there was a general strike in Greece, and there were 60,000 people in the streets of Athens protesting austerity, chanting slogans such as EU IMF out and we won't submit to the Troika, the Troika being the three-party coalition now governing Greece. But apparently today, the three-party troika came up with another austerity measure, another austerity package of cuts. So tell us about, let's start with yesterday. What was it like on the streets of Athens yesterday?
There were a lot of people, like you said. It was a big demonstration. And what actually was even more interesting was that there were big demonstrations in the provinces as well, which is more unusual.
And most of it was peaceful, I take it, but there was a group of masked activists who went after the Etinomia, the paramilitary unit. Is that what they're called?
The MAT. They're the riot police.
The riot police, yeah.
Yeah, it's a known sort of animosity, let's say, between a very small group of protesters and the riot police.
And that, of course, got international headlines with chunks of marble and Molotov cocktails flying around.
Right. It's a sensational image for the news. What happens on a local level is the riot police use it as an excuse to tear gas the entire demonstration. There's a disproportionate use of tear gas towards the entire demonstration rather than just directed at the few troublemakers.
And in terms of the general strike, did the police join in that general strike?
No, unfortunately. They have, the union-affiliated police have had their own demonstrations. They've been pretty vocal.
And politically, where do the police stand?
The majority certainly isn't union-affiliated with a sort of left-wing union. In Athens, high numbers voted for the neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn.
That's a scary prospect, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So, Irini Espathiou, who's in Athens, Greece, and a Greek-American artist and supporter of Syriza, the new party on the left, which is opposed to the Greek government's austerity measures imposed on the Greek people by the European Union and the IMF. Alex Tsipras, the leader of Syriza, he is in Brussels, and he was railing against the austerity measures, saying that they weren't working and were leading to the collective suicide of the Greek people and the Greek economy. Is support for him growing in Greece?
It's hard to tell. I mean, public opinion is still pretty fractured, and the polling shows that the all the parties are around the same numbers as they were in the elections. But with the alarming rise of this neo-Nazi party, the Golden Dawn.
So
they seem to be the only people who are polling differently than in the most recent election.
So they're on the rise.
And, yeah.
And Syriza's leader, Tsipras's, call to change the whole nature of the bailout programs itself. He's saying that this program is a dead end, it cannot work, it cannot function. And he's calling instead for a European conference on debt, similar to what was held after the Second World War that resulted in the cancellation of more than half of Germany's debts. Now, is that getting any traction in Greece or in Europe itself?
Well, I'm not sure about the rest of Europe, but the Greek society is essentially bankrupt or on the way there. The Greek people are already bankrupt. Education is falling apart. The healthcare system is falling apart. So I think people find it hard to imagine that something isn't going to change.
And what about the general notion that what will change is that Greece will reach a point where it will say enough is enough and will leave the euro? Is that still on the table?
I don't think people are so concerned about that anymore. I mean, for sure it's a concern, but the more pressing issue of not being able to pay your bills and the kind of unraveling of the social fabric seems to have eclipsed this, it's not working anymore. You're going to leave the euro if you don't do austerity, I think is becoming a less and less convincing argument.
Well,
I mean, it's hard to convince people that don't have any money that it could be worse.
I see. Well, this, of course, is the fifth year of a recession in Greece.
Right.
And unemployment has reached about 25%, has it not?
Yeah, and people are underemployed and they're cutting across the boards, cutting salaries, pensions.
So is there two universes here then, the universe that you're living in, and the universe that Prime Minister Antonis Samaras and his Finance Minister Yanis Stournaris are living in as they hammer out these these packages of spending cuts to meet another deadline and yet another EU bailout?
For sure. But that isn't a surprise. I mean, these people are the political elite that have been running the country for 30 years.
And it sort of doesn't matter who's in charge? In terms of the...
Well, from the two formerly big parties, yeah. Well, they're in a coalition with the left-wing alibi, the Democratic left, a smaller, moderate left party that joined the coalition. So PASOK and Nea Dimokratia are in a... They're affectionately called the internal troika.
The troika, that's what...
The internal troika, as opposed to the external troika.
I see. And what would the external troika be?
Well, the external troika is the European Central Bank, the European Commission, the IMF, all the people who are overseeing our various bailout.
I see. So when the protesters yesterday in the general strike that shut down the Acropolis, halted flights, ferry services, suspended schools, shops, gas stations were closed, hospitals functioned on emergency staff. All that happened yesterday. So the chants on the street, "We won't submit to the troika," referred to both the internal and the external troika.
I would think so, yeah.
I see. So you're living in Athens, a Greek-American artist, Irini Espathiou. So what's your feeling then about the country that you're in? You have an escape exit, right? You can always come back to America.
True.
But something clearly keeps you there. What is it that keeps you there and in solidarity with the Greek people?
Well, although the country is in many ways falling apart and the polarization of society is really difficult, and there's a level of violence just below the surface, which is also upsetting, I think that there is the possibility of change here. I still feel that it's a small country, and it's standing up to a deeply unjust neoliberal policy that is being imposed upon it. So that's, in a way, exciting.
So the notion that the Greek people are being punished because of the corruption and the incompetence of their political leaders and the lenders, the European banks that lent to these crooked politicians, they're not being punished. The crooked politicians are still in power.
Right.
But the people who are expected to pay the price for the recklessness of the lenders and the dishonesty and incompetence and corruption of the borrowers are the Greek people.
That definitely seems to be the case.
And what do you think will change this?
An entirely different approach to pretty much everything.
I see. So you're talking about revolution, right? But you also said that the party that's growing in strength and coming out of nowhere is this New Dawn fascist party.
Well, they can't run a state, though. I mean, they're a gang of thugs, mm-hmm. literally. I mean, with criminal records, and they're a gang of thugs. So
the alternative would be...
They certainly can't run a state.
Right, but the...
Syriza, I believe, can run a state.
Syriza. So that's your hope, that Syriza will become a majority party.
Yeah, and democratically. You know, I don't hope for an uprising with violence in the streets. I hope for a democratic process of change.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you.
From Athens, Irini Espasiou, and giving us a sense of where things stand. And again, all the best to you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking to Irini Espasiou, who is a Greek-American artist who lives in Athens, Greece. She's a supporter of Syriza, the new party on the left opposed to the Greek government's austerity measures imposed on the Greek people by the European Union and the IMF. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the growing tensions between Japan, China, and Taiwan over a small group of islands in the East Pacific. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Steve Clements, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clements served as Executive Director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is now on the board. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clements.
Great to be with you again, Ian.
And this long simmering territorial dispute, which goes back a century, is now coming to a boil between China, Japan, and Taiwan over the resource-rich Senkaku Island chain in the South China Sea. Before we get into the history, what's your sense of where this is going to go? Could we have a collision here and an accidental escalation?
You can have an accidental escalation, but I suspect that, and I suspect you'll have an accidental escalation up to the point where it comes up to the Chinese premier and to the Japanese prime minister to make, you know, more profound decisions about what they're willing to sacrifice and put on the line for these small islands out in the middle of nowhere. It's you know, we joke about it in one level, but it's a serious issue on the other, because the United States is allied with Japan and has, while it is telling all parties to, you know, keep their powder dry and to keep heads cool with regard to these islands. We're formally obligated to defend Japan's territory if it is attacked. And thus, this is a very serious situation for us because we have a binding obligation. On the Chinese side, you have a lot of Chinese nationalists who are whipping up memories of Japanese atrocities in World War II and you know, basically leveraging the very deep resentment inside Chinese society to use these islands as a way to move their agenda, which is to basically animate a clash and to generate a system or a moment in the world where Chinese is given the respect they feel it's due after 300 years of disrespect. So there's a lot going on beyond the islands themselves. I think in the near term, you're probably going to have numerous cases, like you had this very bizarre case where the Japanese Coast Guard and Taiwanese vessels had essentially a water cannon fight. And it's interesting to see the Taiwanese defending these islands as well. So everyone's throwing in a claim, and they're throwing in a claim not because of history necessarily, but because of the oil and gas and other mineral reserves that may be in the region just around these islands.
Well, Steve Clemens, there is a history, though. In 1895, after Japan's victory in the Sino-Japanese War, Japan gained control of Taiwan, then Formosa, and these islands in Senkakus. And then when Japan surrendered to the Allies in World War II, it left Taiwan in the hands of China's then nationalist regime.
That's
and,
right.
And that became, of course, the Republic of China. And at the same time, the Senkaku Islands remained under the administration of the U.S. Government. The U.S. occupied the islands at the end of World War II. And then they returned them to the Japanese in 1972 over the objections of mainland China. So, you know, there's a theory that in many ways World War II didn't end in China and perhaps in Japan.
Right. I mean, part of this is whether those islands were considered to be part of Taiwan or part of the Ryukyu Island chain, which was part of Okinawa, which, of course, became part of Japan before that 1895 Sino-Japanese War. So that's part of the dispute. And the interesting thing is Nick Kristof of the New York Times has been able to show that even back then there were occasional moments in Meiji documents that recognized these islands as part of China. At the same time, the Chinese readily say, and many of them say, that the Qing Dynasty was so weak back then, this is before 1895, that it did not defend those islands from Japan's takeover. So part of it is a dispute that occurred before the line in history where all of Japan's aggressively annexed territories after 1895, which were returned or forfeited, Japan is saying that this particular island was not part of that because it was part of the Ryukyu Island chain. So we do have really what's a kind of mystery and sort of a whodunit when in a way that's fascinating because you can find documentation in both sides that each side sort of recognized that the other had administrative control and to some degree some form of sovereignty. And I think it's one of those cases where, you know, many of us have been commenting, think it ought to go to the International Court of Justice for resolution. But right now, I think, frankly, nationalists in Japan and nationalists in China are having too much fun, poking each other over this. And there are serious economic consequences of the resolution. And, eventually, hopefully they'll find some way to either, divide sovereignties and think about, the assets that would manage this in a way that both parties are. But I'll tell you how history, the great line that somebody gave me once, he said, history is often renegotiated by powers that become strong, and China is essentially renegotiating the history over these islands.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who's a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, and he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is now a board member. So, but underlying this, of course, are these deep historical grudges. Seven decades later, the wartime adversaries, Japan and China, don't agree over how the war started and who was responsible for it and how to bury the hatchet, if you will. The Chinese public apparently think that China defeated Japan. And, of course, the Japanese know that they were defeated by the United States, not China. So what's the possibility here of, and we've heard for the longest time about Japan's benign view of its actions in World War II and the sanitizing of school textbooks and controversial visits to the Yakasuni Shrine by politicians, etc. What do you think it's going to take for these two countries to get over World War II?
A heck of a lot more leadership in both places. In Japan, if you go to the Yasukuni Shrine, this is a shrine that in part is dedicated to Class A war criminals, but in addition to many other, you know, the millions of others of Japanese war dead, and you go to the museum, you see clear whitewashing of Japan's responsibility for much of World War II. It's really outrageous. I've been through there several times with folks from the Open Society Institute and others that are just appalled by what they've seen. And so I think that the problems of historical memory, which you and I have talked about over many years, continue to plague Japan, and it continues to build mistrust among other powers in the region. This was stronger and more animated in Asia when Japan was perceived to be a rising power and, you know, more of an, you know, an economic menace, if you will, and its footprint was growing in Southeast Asia and Asia and Korea and in China. Japan's economic stagnancy has diminished that somewhat, but what's happened is the stridency of Japanese nationalism has risen as Japan's economy has kind of gone into the doldrums. And so it's out there to be, you know, it does poke China. It does still go on. And you did have, as I wrote in the Washington Post sometimes, you had a kind of dark nationalism that has been rising in Japan where you had Japanese legislators that were trying to say we need to be responsible about our war past, we need to recognize the things that we did, and they would, their homes would be firebombed or they would be threatened, or an Asahi Shimbun writer, you know, a newspaper writer, you know, sort of on the progressive side of things, was killed. And so this Japanese right-wing violence lurks inside the country on the periphery, and it's a real problem. And in China, Chinese textbooks blame Japan for everything. And you had, you know, many horrors occur in China during World War II, but you had many horrors that occurred after under Mao and others. And so they don't generally present a balanced picture of their history. And I think they do spend an exorbitant amount of the, you know, time, you know, the percentage of historical teaching. If you, anyone that goes to China and watches late night TV, it's packed with movies that are essentially about Japanese atrocities. So it's embedded very deep in Chinese psyche. And I think that what does it take to get out of that? Well, there was a case when one of the Japanese prime ministers went over to play, you know, baseball with Wen Jiabao. You show the world that you can get along, that you can, you know, forge common interests, that you can address, you know, the horrors of the past and try and be responsible about the future without denying the bad things that happened. But that takes leadership, and that's often harder to do than these kind of cheap nationalism shots that are taking place right now.
Well, Steve Clements, we have a leadership transition underway in China following a scandal that reached to the top of the Communist Party. And Chinese Party Secretary Hu Jintao, it's reported that he may actually remain officially as the head of China's military. Clearly, the Chinese leadership have played with nationalism as a political tool since Tiananmen, where they've managed to put democracy on the back burner and nationalism on the front burner. But that's a double-edged sword. I mean, they turn it on like a tap and turn it off. The police, you know, literally orchestrate these demonstrations against Japanese property and companies, etc., in China. My understanding, by the way, you mentioned Mao. I spoke the other day to a former bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Beijing, and he's in touch with the Chinese dissidents. And he said that, I said, what about those posters of Mao they're covering? What's that mean, that they're harking back to Mao? And he said, no, they're carrying those posters of Mao to say to their leadership, you guys aren't Mao. You're just a bunch of fakes compared to Mao. So if that's true.
Yeah, pencil pushers and bureaucrats, you know, without the resolve of Mao. So certainly you have some of these skirmishes going on.
Right.
But I think the problem, when you begin playing with fire, when you begin playing with a kind of deep nationalist passions, it's hard to turn them on and off. And, you know, to some degree, China can do that maybe over Japanese property. But I have to tell you, no, I was in China when we had allegedly accidentally bombed a Chinese office that we said was a targeting office, intelligence office, in the old Yugoslavia during the Bosnian War. And Jim Sasser was then our ambassador there. And I got to tell you, the Chinese protesters that showed up at the U.S. Embassy and thought that we had basically gone into an informal war with China, and you saw the people turn out. That wasn't orchestrated by police. You could see this was palpable. I was there. It was scary. And so to a certain degree, if you were to have that kind of thing occur in Sino-Japanese protests again, it's very, very hard to bottle that up and turn it on and off. And so I think it does take responsible management and leadership at the top, and we're not seeing that. I think it's right now, until the Chinese leadership transition is resolved, you're not going to see responsible behavior from the Chinese government.
So is, though, there a growing anti-Chinese coalition, even in the recent summit between APEC with Putin and Hillary spending some time together? My understanding is that even the Russians are now sort of a little wary of China, and they've always been wary of China.
I think the Russians are playing all sides. I mean, they're with China a bit here on Syria, occasionally concerned, and walking a different line on Iran. But everyone recognizes that Chinese economic mercantilism in the world, combining with a very, very big investment in ongoing security and just behaviors that aren't the status quo behaviors we've expected from China, is raising a lot of questions. And when it gets into renegotiating territorial disputes and throwing in Chinese military muscle, what people don't realize is that China has territorial disputes with just about everybody, not just Japan, but with Russia, with India, with Pakistan, with Vietnam. And so as they see one skirmish going on and looking at Chinese behavior, they worry that it'll become a template for how China will deal with them. And I think these territorial disputes have given a bit of spook to Putin and may explain part of why he's cozying up to Hillary Clinton.
So, but isn't it logical, though, Steve Clemens, that the more China asserts itself as a rising power, the more you will get an alliance against it from all those countries that you mentioned?
Partly yes. I mean, I think that's in part what explains some of the transitions in Burma today, that Burma's concerned. I mean, Burma is one of the most retrograde, governments in the world and moved, and I don't think they particularly moved because they were persuaded by Senator Jim Webb and others and John McCain to see the right side of things. I think they were moved for geostrategic reasons and concerns about Burma's long-term security. And, many people may dispute this, but I suspect that's there. But we don't know how that will go. So you may get not an alliance, but at least a circle of concern about Chinese behavior, and that may drive some of these countries to hedge against China, hedge and develop other sort of security dialogues and other concerns. But China, has one big asset that the United States doesn't right now. It's the leading creditor nation in the world next to Japan, and the United States is the world's leading debtor. So China is going to be at the edge of defining the economic behaviors in the world for a generation ahead. And that's going to be a very seductive force for many, many governments, even if they're concerned about China's geostrategic interests.
But isn't there something else that we should be wary of, Steve Clemens, and that is the exaggeration of China's military ambitions by hawks in this country, particularly the neoconservatives who in many ways used Taiwan to gin up a crisis during the Bush administration. And, Secretary of State Colin Powell was able to dampen things down and deal with the incident at the very beginning of the Bush administration. With
the EP-3 incident in Hainan Island, yeah.
Right. So, they've just got an aircraft carrier that everybody's getting excited about. Well, it's a piece of junk from the Ukraine.
Yeah, but, I mean, China's going to matter significantly. It's going to have a large, empowered military down the road. But China, as you said, China has never demonstrated itself as an expansionist power. But you need to go back and study maps. And what does animate the Chinese psyche is anything it controlled at major points in its history, it wants back. Because it feels that it has been humiliated and mistreated and diced up and beaten up by other great powers in the world. And it is back, and it's going to reassert itself. That's not the same thing as what the Soviets did in terms of acquiring great swaths of land and building an empire. My sense is that China is drawing a circle around its sphere of what it considers to be its historical and natural interests, and those are the zones that I think will need to worry. And whether that animates the hawks or not, I suspect that historically we're going to be at this for a while. This isn't going to be quickly resolved, and hopefully China, which also puts a premium on you know balance right now of maintaining calm in the world, because its primary focus is how to raise another 300 million people out of poverty and to keep its economic juggernaut going. It does not want to get distracted in conflicts like this.
Well, Steve Clements, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded, with Chalmers Johnson, the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is now a board member. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how, while Republicans suppress the vote, Democrats could be increasing their voters. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and political professional. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts, written with his friend Rob Ritchie, with whom he founded Fair Vote, an organization dedicated to reforming our elections to respect every vote and every voice through bold approaches to increase voter turnout, meaningful ballot choices, and fair representation. He has an article at The Nation, The Blue State Strategy for Progressive Renewal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
So I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, Stephen, that the Republicans have a pretty long strategy here. And with Karl Rove pretty much the spear carrier, they caught the Democrats by surprise in 2010 through a tremendous amount of funding and coordination with big groups like the American Petroleum Institute. They ran Tea Party and conservatives in the swing states, captured the legislatures and the governorships in these swing states, and then immediately enacted ALEC and this voter suppression legislation, which was designed to affect the 2012 elections that we're now in. Do you think they're going to pull it off? I mean, with a combination of voter suppression and unlimited money?
Well, you know, it really depends on how close the election is in general. I mean, even with all the attempts they're doing at voter suppression, the reality is you don't affect that many votes. But if the election is close enough, like it was in 2000 in Florida, where George Bush, in the official tally, beat Al Gore by 537 votes out of some, 20 million voters, then these sorts of efforts can pay off. So their strategy is basically a hedging strategy. If it's extremely close, they're hoping these sorts of strategies might make the difference in who actually wins. That's what they're hoping to do.
So in terms of that possibility in this election, do you think that the Green Party could help elect Romney? I mean, what are they polling at now? They've sort of gone down in numbers since Nader, haven't they?
Yes, the Green Party's numbers are certainly lower than they were when Ralph Nader ran in 2000 and even in 2004. But there again, it's all dependent on how close the election is. I mean, the presence of Greens, the presence of these voter suppression tactics, they don't affect ultimately how close the election is. They will have an impact if the election is extremely close, like it was in 2000 or even 2004 in Ohio. And keep in mind that this is not a national election per se, because we already can tell you who's going to win about, you know, 40, maybe even 43 of the states. It's going to come down to just a handful of battleground states. And among the seven battleground states, the two most important are going to be Ohio and Florida, as they were in 2004 and as they were in 2000. So, you know, that's where the battle is going to be fought. And that's where either the presence of a Green candidate or the voter suppression tactics could potentially make a difference if it's close enough. I mean, when an election is being decided by 537 votes, you know, if the Green Party candidate gets 0.1% of the vote, that could be enough to pull sufficient votes away from the Democratic candidate to throw the election to the Republican. There are other minor party candidates running as well, including a Libertarian Party candidate. You know, this has worked in the other direction. There are several seats in the U.S. Senate were won by Democrats because a Libertarian Party candidate, you know, looks like pulled enough votes from the Republican candidate to have the Democrat get elected. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out. That's going to be the interesting thing.
Well, of course, Stephen Hill, you have worked against this anomaly where in 2000 environmentalists voted for an environmentalist, Ralph Nader, to help defeat another environmentalist, Al Gore, and elect an anti-environmentalist, George W. Bush. And if we had instant runoff voting, which you've worked to get in San Francisco, Oakland, and Minneapolis, if that were nationwide, the problem wouldn't exist in the first place, would it?
No, it wouldn't. So that would allow voters to rank a first, second, and third choice. And the way it works is if your first choice can't win, so let's say you voted for Ralph Nader, or this year Jill Stein for Green Party, if Jill can't win, then your vote goes to your second choice as your backup choice. It's like having a runoff election, but doing it all in a single vote. And so that would allow the true majority winner to emerge without all these accusations of spoilers and split votes and all these things that have been troubling the presidential elections as well as many other elections for quite a few years. I mean, you know, the reality is if we'd used instant runoff voting in the 2000 presidential election in Florida, the 10,000 or so Ralph Nader voters, excuse me, I think he had like 100,000 voters. Yeah, it was close to 100,000 voters. 90,000, they would have had the option of ranking a second choice. And tens of thousands of them would have put Al Gore, and Al Gore would have been the recipient of those runoff votes, and he would have won Florida and hence the presidential election. So these are the sorts of methods that really are, you know, they're just better, more efficient methods for determining the true will of the voters. And the methods we're using now are actually make it possible for the candidate that doesn't have the most support to win. And, you know, it's just kind of strange that we continue to use these antiquated methods. I mean, other places around the world, like Australia and Ireland, that are using these ranked ballot methods, I mean, they come here and they think, my God, why would you use a method that makes it possible for the candidate that has the least amount of support to win? That's not what democracy is supposed to be about. And yet here in the United States, we continue to use these old antiquated methods that produce the wrong winners.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who's a writer, columnist, and political professional. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. He has an article at The Nation, The Blue State Strategy for Progressive Renewal. So given that the Republicans are trying to both buy the vote and steal the vote in 2012, your article at The Nation, Stephen Hill, argues that there's an awful lot of things that the Democrats could have done and still could do to level the playing field.
Right. Well, because what we hear a lot from Democrats, progressives, Greens, and others is that, you know, the Republicans control the House, and so it's really hard for a Democrat to get anything through that House because the Republicans won't cooperate, so the federal level is completely paralyzed. And, you know, there's been a lot of frustration with Obama that he wasn't sufficiently able to get things moving even when he had control of the Congress. And so there's this sort of sense now that we're stuck playing defense, fighting these voter suppression efforts, fighting against the Koch brothers. And the point of the article that I wrote for The Nation is that there are actually almost a dozen states right now that have what I call the trifecta. They have a Democratic governor, and they have Democrats controlling both houses of the state legislature. And in those states, there are no obstructionist Republicans. There's no filibuster. There's no Fox News ditto heads that are preventing the Democrats from passing true progressive legislation. It's only Democrats that are stopping this from going forward in those states. And so the article sort of thinks out loud and says, okay, imagine if you were the Democratic governor of this state where you have a Democratic-controlled legislature, what would you pass? And then it goes through and it lists a number of important reforms that Democrats in these states should pass right away. And if they did that, they would become national models. So if it ever reaches a point where the federal government becomes, you know, not so much drowning in quicksand, these would become models that we could use at the federal level as well. And so some of the things I propose, for example, automatic voter registration. You know, you look at all the voter suppression efforts going on right now, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, the democratic norm around the world is not to have this kind of voluntary voter registration, you know, where you have to fill out this form and, you know, each side tries to keep the other side from getting their voters registered. The democratic norm is just simply automatic voter registration to get to 100% universal voter registration. The government takes responsibility for registering everybody. And the way they do that is they simply give everyone a unique identifier at some point in your life, like we have a Social Security number, and that becomes your voter ID number that follows you throughout your voting life. And they use that to register you no matter where you live, no matter who you are, what race, youth, age, anything, everyone is 100% registered. This is what Democrats could do at the state level, and there's nothing to prevent them from doing it, and yet they aren't doing it. So, I mean, really, it's not the Republicans' fault that their Democrats aren't pushing automatic voter registration in the states that they control. That's Democrats' fault. And, you know, I expect Republicans to do voter suppression. That's just, it's in their best interest. So that's what they do. But, you know, we need to quit blaming Republicans for what they're doing, instead put the pressure on Democrats to do the things that they can do to counteract that, like universal voter registration. Quit playing defense and play some offense for a change. That's the message of the article.
So, Stephen Hill, what you're talking about, of course, is the norm in all other established democracies around the world. Citizens are usually registered automatically when they reach the age of eligibility. And it's worth pointing out the states that the Democrats already control with the trifecta, that's the governorship and both legislatures, are California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Maryland, Washington, Arkansas, West Virginia, Hawaii, Delaware, and Vermont. So your argument basically is that there's an awful lot that they already have to work with, and if they started this fair method, which, you know, I've always been astounded at how Americans have no concept of how rigged their democracy is from the get-go, with all of these impediments of registration, all of which are clearly designed to suppress the vote. That's the tradition. And, of course, from the days of the Founding Fathers, who only wanted white men of property to vote, the states have always controlled the process. So,
right. I mean, I think the way you put it is quite correct, Ian, that we're looking a lot at the voter suppression that's going on in this election, the tactics that the Republicans and conservatives are using. But the reality is that the voter suppression has already happened, because they've already constructed the laws to make it hard to register. And so what they're doing is just adding on to the general voter suppression that's been going on for years and could easily be addressed by Democrats in these Democrat trifecta states like California. I mean, why is it that the Democrats in California and Governor Jerry Brown have not already passed this? And, in fact, we had a bill in the state legislature when I directed the political reform program at the New America Foundation in 2009 to bring universal voter registration, automatic voter registration to California. And the Republicans, of course, fought it fiercely. They called it un-American. Okay, I expect that. But the Democrats in the legislature didn't really embrace it. In fact, even the Secretary of State of California, Deborah Bowen, who's, you know, considered a progressive, she put the brakes on it. And so, you know, this is, the Democrats are doing this. This isn't Republicans. And that's what people have to realize, is that there are things Democrats could be doing right now in these different states. And I list a number of them in this article in The Nation. Automatic voter registration is just one of them. Proportional representation. More open up the political system. Democrats could be passing that at the state level in these states. Public financing of campaigns, free media time, that would counteract the terrible ruling known as Citizens United. Democrats could be doing that. And then I look at other areas beyond political reform, for example, feed-in tariffs, which were pioneered in Germany, which basically uses the free market to really boost alternative energy sources by making energy producers, they get paid by companies that transmit energy 3 to 4 times the amount for producing that energy through solar and wind power and other renewables than they get for conventional sources. And by doing this, you immediately create a market and all sorts of investment pours into renewables. And this is what Germany and other countries in Europe have done. And as a result, Germany is now a world leader in solar and wind power, far more solar and wind power in Germany than there is in the United States, even though their country is much smaller than what we have here. So these are the sorts of things that Democrats could be doing in all these states instead of whining about Republicans, whining about the Koch brothers, whining about Fox News. They could go on the offense instead of playing defense all the time by passing these things at the state level.
And, of course, Stephen Hill, nearly a quarter of eligible voters, that's 51 million Americans, are not registered, according to a recent Pew Center study. And most of these unregistered voters disproportionately come from the ranks of racial minorities, the poor and the young, the very group that the Republicans are suppressing. So, in other words, there's an awful lot of pickings out there to be had, right?
Well, yeah, and not only are the Republicans suppressing that, but flip it the other way. Those demographics, poor people, minorities, young people, for the most part, are Democratic voters. So this is the ultimate irony here. If the Democrats were to pass something like automatic voter registration in California, not only would it be the good thing to do and the right thing to do and make us put us in line with the standards that are used in established democracies around the world, but it would also be good for the Democratic Party. I mean, this is the ultimate, I don't know what else word to use other than it's just stupidity of the Democratic Party, is that they can't even figure out how to do something that would be not only the good and right thing to do, but something that would actually be good for their electoral prospects into the future. And that's what, in the article in The Nation, pretty much all the examples I have are types of legislation and policy that the Democrats could do that would be both the good and right thing to do and would also be good for Democrats. And yet they're not doing any of it in these states in which that are completely under their control. This is the real baffling thing about the Democratic Party.
Well, it's pretty amazing that they're spending all their efforts, in courts and arguing on MSNBC about how terrible the Republicans are. And clearly the Republicans are cynical and all of their claims about voter fraud are completely bogus. It's worth noting that the purge in Florida only turned up, I think, about 100 anomalies in the vote. In other words, there are about 100 voters in all of Florida, most of whom are elderly people with green cards who thought that they were eligible to vote, but they're not really U.S. citizens, even though they've lived here for decades. It's all pretty pathetic, the arguments on the other side. You're saying is that there are ways to do end runs around this. And so if these Democratic states were to make it easy to vote in the way that the rest of the civilized world operates, including next door in Mexico, by the way, where you get a voter card when you turn 18, and it's tamper-proof, and you have it for life. How do you expect this, though, to spread to the red states, who would, of course, would resist it, particularly those that have the legacy of Jim Crow and now what is called Juan Crow, the suppression of Latinos as well as blacks?
Well, you know, to my way of thinking, let's take it one step at a time. I mean, if we can get it passed in the nearly dozen states that are controlled by Democrats, that then becomes, at that point, it becomes, well, why aren't these other states doing it? It's just the fair and right thing to do. Even for those who are concerned about voter fraud, for example, that Pew study that you cited that's in the Nation article, they found that there were approximately 24 million inaccurate registrations nationwide. If we used universal voter registration, it would resolve all those 24 million inaccurate registrations. I mean, basically, by using universal voter registration, it removes registration from the contested field of politics. And that, because you're not arguing over who is or who isn't registered anymore and who should or shouldn't be allowed to vote, because everyone is registered, 100%. And so for those who truly are concerned about voter fraud, and we realize that a lot of the Republican red flag around voter fraud is disingenuous, it's just an excuse to do the voter suppression stuff they're doing. But there are some who are generally concerned about voter fraud. And for those who are, universal voter registration, automatic voter registration is the way to deal with it. So that's where I think that, you know, if it was passed in a half a dozen Democratic states and working fine, then it would just be a matter of time before even some conservatives who are fair-minded would say, hey, this is going to deal with voter fraud much better than the attempts we're doing now. We're going to try it in some of our red states as well. So I think the idea would spread of its own merit. But, you know, the Democrats should move forward with it first and quit using Republicans as excuses for this kind of thing.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Hill, my understanding is that the Patriot Act that was passed after 9/11 has a provision in it for a national ID card, and it's never been enacted because there's a lot of civil libertarians have objections to it. The theory being that the fact that there are millions of Americans inside of America who are under the radar was considered after 9/11 a national security threat because most of the hijackers were able to get phony IDs, etc., that was the impetus for it. Is there a possible political trade-off here between conservatives and progressives? In other words, if conservative defense or homeland security hawks, shall we say, want to know who's in the country and to have everybody have a national ID card, wouldn't it be worth it for progressive civil libertarians to accept that, provided it was also, this card was also a lifetime voter registration card?
I think that would certainly be a compromise worth considering, because the reality is, you know, many countries around the world who are just as respectful of civil liberties as the United States is, and in many cases more respectful, they do have national ID cards and they do have voter IDs and these sorts of things. And those are the method that is used to enact 100% universal voter registration. And so it seems to me that, yeah, of course, it's understandable why progressives and Democrats are fighting these voter ID laws, but that it would be interesting maybe to pick out a state and try a compromise saying, okay, you want to do voter ID? That's fine, as long as the government is going to issue a voter ID to every eligible voter in this state, and every eligible voter is automatically registered and the government takes responsibility for 100% voter registration. It seems to me that that trade-off is certainly worth exploring, because the number of people who potentially could be disenfranchised by these voter ID laws is, any vote that doesn't get counted, of course, is not right and not good. But the number is actually not going to be that great compared to, you know, as the Pew study showed, we have 51 million Americans who are eligible to vote, and yet they're not even registered. So we're talking orders of scale, of magnitude greater, that by having a 100% voter registration approach, we would be enfranchising tens of millions of voters compared to the few thousand who might be disenfranchised by the use of a voter suppression, voter ID law. So I think it's certainly worth exploring that, you know, okay, if the Republicans are going to have the vote in some states to push a voter ID law, making a compromise with them, okay, voter ID, fine, 100% universal voter registration as well, let's give it a try. I think it's worth exploring.
And what do you think can be done about the Electoral College? You started out the interview by pointing out that most of the country doesn't even know an election's going on. We already know what the results are going to be in most of the states. It's only the swing states where the money's being spent and where the vote counts, in effect. And a lot of these are legacies of this disproportionate rural bias that the Electoral College has. Is there any way, that, I know there were some efforts to reform the Electoral College. Where do they stand?
There is an effort, and it's going forward and making a great deal of progress. It's called the National Popular Vote Plan. Nationalpopularvote.com is the website for it. And what they have a very innovative approach here because, you know, to get rid of the Electoral College require a constitutional amendment, which is very tough to pass. But their plan actually gets around the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment because the states are allowed by the Constitution to decide how to allocate their state's electors. So a state, for example, could most states allocate them. The winner of their state gets 100% of that state's electors. But two states, Nebraska and Maine, actually, you have to win each congressional district, and each congressional district has a electoral vote assigned to it. Well, the National Popular Vote Plan says it asks states to pass a law saying our state will give 100% of our state's electors to the winner of the national popular vote. And the once enough states have passed that in aggregate have the 270 electoral votes you need to win the presidency, at that point it becomes a de facto national popular vote. And at this point, enough states have passed this law to have about half that 270. I think they're up to about 140 electoral votes. So states like California and Massachusetts and Illinois have passed this. So they're halfway there. And if they can get other states to go along with this over the next few years, it's possible by 2016 we will be electing the president using a national popular vote, a direct election of the president, which right now is not occurring.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Hill.
My great pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hill, who's a writer, columnist, and political professional. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts, written with his friend Rob Ritchie, with whom he founded Fair Vote, an organization dedicated to reforming our elections to respect every vote and every choice through bold approaches to increase voter turnout, meaningful ballot choices, and fair representation. He has an article at The Nation, The Blue State Strategy for Progressive Renewal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. I'll be back again at 11 a.m. on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.